Welcome to the Maritime History Program. I'm your host, Brandon Huebner, and this week we move on to Episode 5, Meanwhile in Egypt. Our first four episodes have looked at trade, boating, merchant shipping, and history overall in ancient Mesopotamia. As you might have guessed from today's title, we're now going to turn the focus of our discussion from the maritime exploits of Mesopotamia over to the land of the pharaohs. And as we do so, we're going to turn back the clock from where it stood when we finished our look at Mesopotamia. We left that region at a point in time near the decline that occurred after Hammurabi's death. But as we enter Egypt, our discussion will begin at a time prior to the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, which was before the dynastic divisions by which we organize our understanding of ancient Egypt and its history. If we had to put a date on it, the pre-dynastic Egyptian period stretches back in time, beginning at around 3000 BCE, going back from there. So pre-unification Egypt is roughly concurrent with the periods of Mesopotamia before the Sumerian dynasties. All right. So even in the mention of an upper and a lower Egypt, the current running under the surface of Egyptian history is present. And of course, that current is the Nile River, the lifeblood of Egyptian civilization for millennia. Some have called it a conduit, others have likened it to a highway, and perhaps the most famous description comes from Herodotus, where he describes the Nile as a gift giver, bestowing the gift of life upon Egypt herself. Sometimes repeated focus on the same point can make it trite, but in the case of Egypt and maritime history, the Nile really is the foundation that made Egypt a great civilization and allowed it to be on the forefront of boat technology as it developed in the ancient world. The Nile River is basically a strip of oasis stretching for thousands of miles. It begins somewhere in the mountains of East Central Africa, and from there it flows north, out of the mountains, and into the desert. Scattered over the course of those several thousand miles, before it branches out to drain into the Mediterranean, the Nile is punctuated by six major groups of cataracts, white water rapids or shallow stretches that are mostly impassable by boat, except during flood time. The first cataract at Aswan was the most significant of the six, and during ancient times it was a natural barrier between Egypt to its north and Nubia to its south. That isn't to say that it was categorically impassable, because pharaohs frequently did push south into Nubia. Rather, the first cataract at Aswan was important because early on in Egypt's history, the kings fortified an island that they called Abu, an island that sat in the Nile, just downstream of the first cataract, and this island was perfectly located to serve as a choke point and transfer station for cargo being shipped on the Nile River. This island and the first cataract were so important because north of Aswan a ship could travel unchecked to the Mediterranean along the free-flowing highway of the Nile, reaching the river's mouth over 750 miles away to the north. Traveling back upstream, while a bit more difficult, was relatively simple when compared to many other rivers around the globe. The whole of the journey back upstream was generally undertaken with the aid of Egypt's predominant northerly wind, a wind blowing from north to south. In this particular case, the Nile and the flow of the river created the perfect situation, since the Nile flows from south to north. Later on today, we will see how Egypt could well have been the first civilization to develop the sail on a widespread basis. And this possibility is probable because of the complementary functions of the Nile's flow and the northerly wind that created the perfect situation for the invention and adoption of the sail. Before we get too far into specific examples that give us a window into pre-dynastic Egypt, I do also want to mention the fact that Egypt wasn't purely limited to the north-south matrix of the Nile into the Mediterranean. While the Nile was integral to the rise of Egyptian civilization, and many of Egypt's important features were contained within the Nile Valley, Egypt also had communication with the Red Sea to the east, via the wadis that cut through the Red Sea hills. The mountains were rich in mineral deposits, and there's a wealth of evidence that the ancient Egyptians mined in the eastern mountains far back into their ancient history. We'll also take a look at some rock carvings from this region that give us a glimpse at some of the oldest boat depictions on Earth. But it's important to keep in mind that Egypt did have a limited measure of contact east and into the Red Sea, although the ultimate extent of that contact is still unknown to us today. With the geography groundwork laid, I think it's also important to take a brief look at just how all-encompassing the Nile was in the mind of the ancient Egyptians. First off, almost all of the Egyptian creation myths had to do with the gods either being from the water or creating the earth from the water. In reality, too, the Nile's water gave life to the civilization, overflowing on an annual cycle and spreading the fertile soil that made crop growth possible along the oasis-like strip that cut through the desert. I was recently reading The Discoverers, which is a great book written by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and former Librarian of Congress in the United States, Daniel Boorstin. In that book, he makes the broad point that the Nile made crop growth possible, which led to an expanding civilization, much like what we saw in our look at Mesopotamia's growth. This growth in turn led to commerce that the Nile facilitated by being a freightway for transportation, not only of crops, but also of the raw materials and obelisks that became symbols of Egypt's state power. This broad point is necessary, but Boorstin makes a second fascinating point, that, quite possibly, the Nile was responsible for Egypt becoming one of the first unified large-scale civilizations. Boorstin attributes that unification to the fact that the Nile floods on an annual basis, a phenomenon that led to the Egyptians delineating time in a fashion almost precisely like that of our modern calendar. Other civilizations, take those in Mesopotamia or Greece, for example, those places measured time based on lunar cycles, which resulted in disparate timekeeping systems that left fragmented city-states predominant. Egypt, on the other hand, was knit together by the annual flooding of the Nile, a readily observable and actually essential occurrence that unified Egyptians in their perception of time. Now, this unification and dependence on the Nile did also lead to a more authoritarian power structure than in those other early societies, but it did also give Egypt an early edge in the ancient world. Enough of that for now, anyways. Now, let's get down to the nitty-gritty examples that really bring life to these somewhat abstract concepts. And we'll start here with some of the early depictions of boats from pre-dynastic Egypt. We are forced to rely on these depictions because almost no textual evidence from such an early period has been found. And even the textual references attached to the early dynasties are still subject to debate in academic circles. As would be expected, and as we saw was the case in Mesopotamia, the earliest of the Egyptian water vessels were most likely papyrus reed floats and boats. There are numerous depictions of what seem to be papyrus boats on jars and clay vases that are generally dated to the pre-dynastic Gersian culture. This was a material culture that's named after artifacts found at a pre-dynastic cemetery in the town of Gerza. The large majority of these Gerzian boat depictions are dated to the centuries around 3300 BCE, and they seem to follow the general depiction of what we would expect for a papyrus reed boat. A symmetrical shape would indicate the tied-off ends of the reed hull, and then the lines drawn downward from the hull may represent paddles or oars. Old Kingdom linguistics also indicate that the earliest boat forms were probably papyrus boats, since the term for constructing a boat carried with it the idea of binding the boat, which you would have to do if your building substance was reed rather than wood. This term continued even after they'd also adopted wooden plank construction techniques. There is the possibility that even at this early stage, the Egyptians were using wood to build their boats, because some of the depictions are asymmetrical, and they conform more to the structure of later wooden boats. The possibility that wooden boats were being built from this very beginning period is made apparent by the reality, as we'll see later on, that even the earliest of the pharaohs had highly developed wooden ships buried in their capital cities or near their mortuary temples. One specific and important artifact seems to be dual proof both that pre-dynastic Egypt used wooden boats and was among the first to develop the sail. A beautiful jar dated to the Nakata III period of pre-dynastic Egypt depicts an elegantly shaped boat with a square sail set on a single pole mast near the front of the boat. The boat's asymmetrical shape seems to indicate that it was built of wood, as a reed boat of this shape with a mast pole in such a position would function quite poorly. Maritime historian Lincoln Payne surmises that as pre-dynastic Egypt developed wooden boats, they mimicked the form of their papyrus boats, at first because they were inexperienced with the new building material, but later on because they consciously sought to imitate the original papyrus boat form. It's an interesting theory, and it's readily apparent that wooden ships had been highly developed and come into wide use by the time of Egypt's unification. Before we get there, let's take a quick look at the most prevalent and the most difficult to interpret boat depictions, the petroglyphs that are scattered throughout Upper Egypt. Although the boat depictions on the jars and vases give us a basic idea of pre-dynastic boats, and they are fairly well documented as well, there are actually more petroglyph boat depictions than any other pre-dynastic type of depiction. The problem is that the petroglyphs are less well documented, and even where there is documentation, dating them is more difficult. The main informative contribution of the boat petroglyphs comes from their location, many of them in the wadis that cut through the eastern mountains to the Red Sea. Many of the wadi petroglyphs depict what we would expect to see in a rock carving of a papyrus boat. One of the most fascinating and possibly the most important petroglyphs was recently discovered, I should say rediscovered, in the Nile village of Nag al-Hamdalab, a village that sits about 6 kilometers north of Aswan. I had to catch myself there to say that the site was rediscovered, because it was originally documented in the 1890s, but it was rediscovered in 2008 by archaeologists who went to great lengths to document the site and attempt to preserve it, since the site had been vandalized at least once. The main rock carving tableau at Nag al-Hamdalab depicts 5 separate boats. 4 of them are nearly identical in shape and size, though it's difficult to say whether they depict papyrus boats or wooden boats. Either type would have been possible, based on the main feature of the petroglyph. That main feature is the central figure who wears the white crown of Upper Egypt, an adornment that has caused some archaeologists to associate the figure with none other than Narmer, the first pharaoh of unified Egypt. Other indicators in this scene further support that conclusion. For instance, the crowned figure is being fanned by what appears to be a servant. The boats themselves are adorned with what looks to be falcon and bull insignias, and many of the pre-dynastic boat depictions that we talked about earlier were also adorned with one of dozens of different standards. Because the falcon and bull insignias became associated with royalty later on as the dynastic period progressed, it's pretty logical to draw the conclusion that this falcon symbol and the white crown can point to the central figure as possibly, even likely, being the first pharaoh. In addition, a hieroglyphic symbol in the tableau labels the scene as a nautical following, which is most likely a reference to the following of Horus. This event in ancient Egypt was an event that consisted of the king and his royal court making a journey along the Nile River Valley, probably as a tax collection and PR tour, to cement the pharaoh's newly won authority over all Egypt. And later pharaohs continued this tradition, doing the same type of tour up and down the Nile River. Now, as fascinating as the petroglyph mural is, and as significant as its possible interpretation also is, there are two other pre-dynastic depictions that I want to mention quickly before we cross over into the early dynastic period. The first artifact is an ivory knife handle that was discovered in Gebel el Arak and is currently kept at the Louvre. The second is a marvelous painting on the brick walls of a Gerzian period tomb in Hierakonpolis. This was the religious and political capital of Upper Egypt as the dynastic period began. Now, I mention these two items in conjunction because each contains a boat type similar to the wooden sailboat on the Nakata 3 jar that I mentioned earlier, the dark-colored sleek boats with one high vertical end. The boats on the Gebel el Arak knife handle actually have two symmetrical high ends, which is a trait that's generally associated with Mesopotamian boats from this period. The Hierakonpolis tomb painting depicts a flotilla of six boats. Five of them are readily identified with the common Egyptian papyrus reed boat, but the sixth boat is nicknamed the Black Boat, because it's quite unique. It has one high vertical end and an oar near the front, unique traits that have led some scholars to call it a foreign boat. At one point, the knife handle and the tomb painting were interpreted together as being dual depictions of the same event, a late pre-dynastic invasion of people from the east. The foreign invaders were once thought to be Mesopotamian in origin, and while that theory has been dismissed, it's still possible that the foreign boats depict Mesopotamian vessels. The theory that resonates most with me personally is that even in pre-dynastic Egypt, both Egypt and Mesopotamia had trade contacts with people in the Levant. Egyptian inscriptions that bear the name of Narmer have been discovered there, and it's feasible that both cultures had interaction in the Levant, that the distinctive design of the Mesopotamian boats made its way to Egypt not via invasion, but rather by Egyptian artists using the design on depictions that had eventually found their way down the Nile to Upper Egypt. This interpretation seems more likely than the invasion interpretation, because very few physical artifacts related to Mesopotamia have been found in Upper Egypt, the place that was supposedly invaded by Mesopotamian sailors. Those depictions that have been found could more easily and more logically have made their way there via trade exchanges, as I described a minute ago. So, while claims of Mesopotamian invasion seem dubious, Egypt certainly had trade connections with the Levant, and even out into the Red Sea. They also seem to have had maritime connections south into Nubia, despite the cataract at Aswan. A beautiful incense burner unearthed at a royal tomb in the Nubian town of Kustal is unquestionably carved in a Nubian artistic style, but it depicts imagery that is readily associated with Egyptian royalty. The carved image encircling the incense burner depicts what seems to be a royal boat procession, with a seated figure again wearing the white crown of Upper Egypt in the central boat. The forwardmost boat contains a prisoner, and the boat appears to contain a square sail set on a single mast, similar again to the design of the Nakata jar. Because the boats are en route to a palace-like structure, the incense burner has been interpreted as depicting a royal procession, possibly, again, the following of Horus. Alright, that's as much as I think we'll consider when it comes to the pre-dynastic period. There is so much more that we could say and speculate about. I mean, there are entire books dedicated to pre-dynastic boats in Egypt. But I do think we've hit the highlights that give us a good base to now transition into the dynastic period. As we've seen, the first named pharaoh, and the one responsible for unifying Upper and Lower Egypt, was Narmer, sometimes also called Menes. I'll try not to get too sidetracked by the political history of Egypt, and if you are interested in the subject, I'd recommend Toby Wilkinson's Rise and Fall of Ancient Egypt, as a concise, accessible glimpse at the high points of Egyptian history. We've already seen how Narmer's name has been found in the Levant, and how other evidence seems to indicate that he also extended his reach south into Nubia. Those facts being the case, it's fairly safe to assume that by the start of the dynastic period, Egypt had already developed wooden boats to a usable degree. Nothing confirms that theory more than a discovery that was made in the ancient Egyptian city of Abydos. Abydos has been called the Giza of the early dynasties. It was the focus of technological innovation and religious development. Early iterations of pyramid-like burial structures have also been found there, and the royal necropolis at Abydos was the resting place of the first pharaohs. The maritime relevant discovery at Abydos technically came from the royal necropolis called El Ka'ab, which is located about a mile outside the ancient city itself. With its imposing temples and wealth of artifacts, Abydos has been the focus of excavation and archaeological work since the inception of modern Egyptology. In 1988, though, Australian Egyptologist Dr. David O'Connor was leading a team at Abydos when they discovered a burial mound which he theorized to be a proto-pyramid. During the same season, they discovered lines of mud brick buried beneath the sand near this structure. Although they initially assumed that the brick structure was the corner of a yet undisclosed enclosure, when they returned to uncover the remaining portion 3 years later, they made what O'Connor called a startling and significant discovery. As digging progressed, the team realized that they were unearthing a series of oddly shaped walls, each one running in the same direction, perpendicular to where the Nile flowed 7 miles to the west. Soon, however, the team realized that these walls were something else altogether. In reality, the walls turned out to be boat graves, 12 of them discovered in 91 alone, and several more later on. The archaeology team wasn't far off in their original assessment, though, because the boats themselves were each enclosed within a brick casing. And although the brick enclosures were low-lying, Once they were uncovered, their boat-like shape was unmistakable. Further examination revealed facts that give us a picture of what the fleet would have looked like several thousand years ago. Each grave had originally been coated in mud plaster and painted white, so an Egyptian at Abydos would likely have seen a fleet of huge boat-shaped enclosures sitting out in the desert, reflecting the bright desert sun. Small boulders placed in similar locations near the prow or stern of many of the boats also seem to indicate ceremonial moorings of the boats to the desert floor. Their sterns, all in a line, pointed toward the Nile in the distance. The whitewashed brick enclosures have been said to look like a ghostly fleet anchored in the Egyptian desert, but the boats contained within the enclosures give us an amazing window into just how advanced Egyptian boat building had become by the time of just the Second Dynasty. The boat graves at Abydos have been dated to the reign of Khasekhemwy, who was the last pharaoh of the Second Dynasty. He ruled, and most of the boats were probably buried somewhere around 2175 BCE. Anyway, following the original discovery, another 10 years passed before the team could arrange the approvals and necessary preservation measures needed to make excavation of a boat grave feasible. In the year 2000, Dr. O'Connor led an excavation that confirmed the hopes they'd harbored throughout the 90s. Each boat grave contained a wooden planked boat that conformed to what the brick enclosures indicated. From the outside, the graves were enormous, their average length measuring in at almost 90 feet, or 27.5 meters, and that despite their narrow width. The widest boat measured about 10 feet or so. The most important information, though, came from the wood itself, and the graves that had not been worn down preserved their contents in an amazing fashion. This preservation was accomplished by the way in which the boats were basically sealed in their graves. A narrow trench was cut in the sand, and the boat's wooden hull then nestled down in the sand. The brick enclosure was then built up around the boat, the inside edge built to mirror the shape of the hull. Several of the boats had the inside of the hull filled in with mud brick, and all of the boat graves were then sealed with mud plaster and painted white on the outside. The wood used to build the boats seems to have been locally sourced, which stands in contrast to the Lebanon cedar wood that came to be used in later Egyptian history. The construction of the boats was accomplished using thick wooden planks that were lashed together by rope fed through mortises. The seams between the planks were filled with bundles of reeds, and more reeds carpeted the floor of the boat. These early boats were not built with internal frames, and some of the boats appear twisted or lopsided, the common fate suffered by vessels without an internal structure to support them out of water. Finally, pigmentation on the boats seems to show that some of them were painted white, while at least one of them was painted yellow. I'd like to go ahead and wrap up our look at the earliest maritime evidence from Egypt with a revealing quote from Dr. O'Connor, where he summarizes the significance of the Abydos boats. He said, quote, "Ancient Egypt is a riverine civilization. Yet before these boats were discovered, we knew very little beyond representations on ancient pots about ancient Egyptian boats earlier than the reign of Khufu, one of the greatest Fourth Dynasty pharaohs." These boats provide us with a window into better understanding Egypt at the dawn of its extraordinary, long-lived civilization. Moreover, recent excavations have confirmed our original guess. These boat graves contain actual and viable boats intended for a king's use in the afterlife. They are, in meaning and function, the direct ancestors of the famous boat recovered at Khufu's Great Pyramid at Giza, and predate Khufu's boat by perhaps as much as 300 years. I should also note in closing that other early boat graves have been discovered at Helwan and Saqqara, two sites connected to the ancient capital of Memphis. But next time, we're going to turn our focus to the Khufu ship that Dr. O'Connor alludes to in that quote. That ship is one of the most beautiful and important maritime discoveries from Egypt's Old Kingdom, perhaps even the entire ancient world. And it's an episode that I particularly enjoyed putting together. Although the Khufu ship is one artifact alone, its size, technicality, and importance justify devoting an entire episode to it. That's all I have for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join me again next week at this same time. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. I hope you'll join me next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.